Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by the renowned writer and literary scholar, Philip Lopate. And we're going to talk about his new edited volume, The Golden Age of the American Essay, 1945 to 1970. It's published in 2021 with Anchor Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House. And Philip, it's an honor to meet you, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Zach, for having me.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about your book, and you have some really interesting essays here that you've included, some classics, some less familiar. But before we get into that, could you first tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you began essay writing?
Well, I was a fiction writer and a poet, and at a certain point, I fell in love with the essay. I realized that to some degree, the essay could combine the storytelling aspects of fiction with the associative aspects of poetry. And I got hooked by the whole tradition of the essay, Montaigne, going down through Hazlitt, Lamb, Virginia Woolf, James Baldwin, George Orwell. I really got sucked into all that, and it became a form that I felt familiar writing in and also teaching. So I did this whole anthology called The Art of the Personal Essay, and it's been a very popular book. It sold about 250,000 copies, and so I became known as a kind of champion of the essay. And then at a certain point, I thought about doing a big anthology of the American essay. Well, that morphed into three volumes. The first volume, The Glorious American Essay, which told the whole story of the American essay from colonial times to the present, was published a few months ago. And now the second volume, The Golden Age of the American Essay, is just coming out. So I am a dyed-in-the-wool essayist, and I love the form. It's freedom, and it's flexibility.
Yeah, very good. Well, I mean, you've had quite a profound career as an essayist. You've won the Guggenheim Fellowship, National Endowment for the Arts grants. You're currently a professor writing at Columbia, and teaching at Columbia. And in this book here, The Golden Age of the American Essay, given us quite a collection of essays, 38 of them that you've selected from this period between World War II and 1970. Let me ask you this, what made these 25 years such a fertile period for American essays?
Oh, lots of things. It just so happens that there were a lot of literary journals that were quite hospitable to essay writing. In fact, even newspapers and magazines welcomed essays at this point. I think that in some ways, it was a watershed moment in which America had to try to figure out where it stood. It was suddenly the champion of the free world. And the most powerful nation. And so its intellectuals felt called upon to understand what was going on. So you had all these publications. You had this singular moment. You had all these problems that had to be addressed, like the Cold War. There was a lot of racism, sexism, the degradation of the environment. You had no end of problems that had to be looked at. So also, you know, there was this whole wave of European intellectuals who had settled in America, and they had kind of raised the intellectual bar, and American intellectuals wanted to write in a way that was more intelligent, you might say. And the essay has always been a form for analysis, a form that privileged intelligence, you might say, over emotion. So this was a good time for the essay.
That's very good. Well, in the introduction of these essays, you spend a little bit of time talking about the idea of liberalism, and you make this connection to the practice or ideology of essay writing. Talk to us about how you're using the term liberal. What's the idea of liberal consensus? And then what's the relationship that you're seeing between essayism and liberalism?
Well, Lionel Trilling said at a certain point that in this time, in this post-war period, that that there was a liberal consensus, in part because radical Marxism had proven to some degree to lead to Stalinism, and so you know, intellectuals moved away from Marxism, and liberalism is something that, in a way, advocates the middle way. The New Deal had you know, of FDR, had been welcomed by writers and intellectuals, and to some degree it had saved capitalism. So liberalism supported reformism. It was you know, liberalism is something that has always been drawn to skepticism, to anti-dogmatism, anti-fanaticism, and to some degree anti-revolution. So this was a good ideology for a moment when intellectuals had lost their appetite for revolution, and they were advocating progressive changes. And this has always been part of the ideology of essays as well. Montaigne, for instance, was someone who advocated the middle way and equanimity, and Emerson, the same thing. So basically, essayism, I'm calling it essayism, but really what I mean is the practice of essays was something that felt very comfortable with self-skepticism, with thinking against oneself, and with a kind of temperate attitude towards things. And so it folded very neatly into liberalism.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, you know, one of the essays you include here, then I guess this is where we should go next, is this essay by Irving Howe, the Age of Conformity. And this is one that shows a bit of wariness of toward liberal consensus. And you say Irving Howe, he wasn't necessarily alone either in this, because a lot of essayists sort of saw themselves as guardians, gatekeepers of particular standards. Can you talk a little bit about this essay? How does Howe talk about or show this kind of wariness in the essay you include here?
Well, Irving Howe was a brilliant social and literary critic, and in this essay, he proves himself to be very skeptical of the liberal consensus, which he felt basically was a mush of didn't have any clarity of ideas and was complacent. He was worried that intellectuals and writers were being co-opted by the academy, co-opted by the bureaucracy, and basically they were being bought off. And so he thought that liberalism was going to lead to a kind of I don't know what to say, a kind of shallowness and a lack of articulation, a lack of edge. And so he was worried about conformity. And I think that in a way he was ahead of the game, because nowadays liberalism is attacked from both the left and the right. Liberalism has become something of a dirty word. You know, at a certain point, nobody wanted to admit that they were liberal. But I do think that to some degree, the liberal tradition has persisted, even though the word itself has lost some of its credibility. So certainly, you know, for a radical like Irving Howe, liberalism was a kind of threat because it moved away from radical solutions. But something to notice is that this very essay is written in a liberal mode. That is, it's written in a very thoughtful, self-skeptical, and reasonable way, which is entirely in the tradition of the literary literature.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Well, you know, Philip, one other thing that stands out here that you say is there was a fair amount of criticism and written debate between writers. And yet you say, as many lambasted one another and had differing opinions in the post-war era, there was this observable intellectual tone in the writing. I'm wondering, can you talk to us about this aspect of essayists writing to show intelligence and show their learning?
Well, some of it came about from a group called the New York Intellectuals, many of whom were Jewish. And were seeking to elbow their way into American culture. And it turned out that that this kind of nonfiction, literary criticism, was a home for them, a way that they could establish their own bona fides, you could say. So they competed with each other. They went up to each other. And there was a kind of competition of ideas. They took ideas seriously. And so in taking ideas seriously, they also criticized each other. And that was allowable, you might say. So I think that it was a period when there was a lot of intellectual showing off, you might say. They had been influenced a great deal by T.S. Eliot and by the English way of doing essays. And there was a certain formal tone to their writing, but they were also using their brains like stilettos, cutting each other, you might say. So this was all part of this kind of intellectual tone that they were adopting. Some of that has certainly disappeared in American letters, but it was very present at that time.
Sure. Well, you know, Philip, that's really helpful. And I guess as we move forward a little bit, we've talked about how this period was such a rich time for the flourishing of essays. But as we think about these particular essays that you've selected here, how did you land on these specifically, and what was the process like of choosing what to include in this book?
Well, to be honest, a lot of them would have gone into the first volume, but the publisher gave me a page limit in that first volume of only 900 pages. In order to put in a lot of these essays, I would have had to done a 2,000-page book, which of course was impossible. But one of the principles I established in that first volume, which I continued in this volume, was I wanted to show how essays could percolate in almost every discipline and almost every form. So, for instance, you could have essays on theology, and I've included one by Reinhold Niebuhr here. You could have essays on art criticism, and I've included a Clement Greenberg one on modern painting. You could have essays on sports, John Updike's piece about Ted Williams. You could have essays on the environment, Rachel Carson writing about pesticides. You could have a piece by Martin Luther King, his letter from Birmingham Jail. I wanted to show how letters, speeches, criticism could all be different ways of doing essays. There's, for instance, a wonderful essay, one of my favorites, by Edwin Denby, the dance critic, called "Dances, Buildings, and People in the Streets," in which he's talking about ways of observing movement. And it connected very well to this period of the 50s, when there was a lot of breakthroughs in art. You had the abstract expressionists, you had the dance of Merce Cunningham or Balanchine, you had jazz, and I have Albert Murray writing about the blues and jazz. So I wanted to show something about how the essay could accommodate any and every genre and any discipline.
And I think you did that really well. It's a fascinating collection. And you know, a lot of these are recognizable. Some of them are anyway. And many are well received today, but how were these essays received at the time they were written? Did people in this period between 1945 and 1970, did they spend time talking about these essays?
I think so. I think that essays were a source of conversation at dinner parties, at gatherings. So, for instance, you had an essay by Leslie Fiedler called Come Back to the Raff Again, Huck Honey, in which he talks about, you might say, the homoerotic tradition in American literature. And it was talked about quite a lot. And then there was this essay by George F. Kennan called The Sources of Soviet Conduct, in which he talks about what the Soviets really were intending, and basically warning America that Stalin and the Soviets did not really wish us that much good. And that was talked about a great deal. So, you know, you had these essays that were very provocative. One of them, for instance, Richard Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style in American Politics is still being talked about. In fact, it's come around, you know, because there's still a lot of paranoia in American politics, to be something that's perennially cited as a kind of keystone way of looking at this problem. So yes, not all of them were talked about, but certainly they were part of the cultural conversation at the time.
Well, Philip, I suspect many of our listeners will be interested in picking up a copy of this volume after they hear this, but could you give us, for some of us who may be on the fence, could you give us a few of the essays which you find most meaningful? What are some of your favorites here included?
Well, I do like all of them, so you're putting me on the spot. But for instance, there's an essay by Lionel Trilling called The Last Lover, in which he analyzes Nabokov's Lolita. And the way he kind of like teases out all the ambivalence and all the contradiction in that novel is really interesting. And then you've got an essay by Elizabeth Hardwick, who was a wonderful essayist, on Boston, which is a somewhat bitchy analysis of Boston, but it is incredibly clever, and well worth reading. I mentioned the Edwin Denby essay, Dances, Buildings, and People in the Street, which I love. But then you've got something like Tom Wolfe's The Girl of the Year, which he just has a tremendous amount of fun writing about this woman who is famous for being famous. And of course, Joan Didion's essay on The Morning After the 60s, which closes the book. Well, Didion has become, you know, a kind of saint of essay writing in a way. And this one is done with her typical intelligence and feeling for the spirit of the age.
Yeah, very good. Well, I think probably a fitting way to wrap up our conversation is to note how this collection is capped off by the year 1970. But can you tell us what happens after this date, though? Is what is the state of essay writing past 1970 and the 21st century, perhaps? And then also, you alluded to this earlier, I think. Would you consider compiling an anthology for this later period?
I have, in fact, compiled an anthology, contemporary American essay, which is devoted to the 21st century, which happens to be this moment a very good time for American essays. You know, 25 years ago, essays were not considered commercial, and publishers were afraid even to put the word essay on the cover of a book. But now there are so many younger essayists who appeal to younger readers. I think that to some degree, the essay has become a way of dealing with identity, with ethnicity, with sex and gender, so that every group has found its voice and its identity by picking up the essay and trying to understand that the nature of that membership, you might say. So we're going through a very good period commercially for the essay, and so people should maybe look out for that third volume, which is the contemporary American essay.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye out for that, and perhaps we can have you back on the show to talk about it.
Well, thanks so much, Zach, for having me this time.
Yeah, great. And thanks so much for writing this book. For everyone listening, it is The Golden Age of the American Essay. It's out with Anchor Books, and it was published just this month in 2021. And Philip, thanks so much for taking the time with us this evening.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you again next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you.